Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This Saturday's date of May 8th makes it now 76 years since VE Day, 1945, which is evermore an historic relic as the World War II generation dies away. It has already a distal obscurity attached, as though it were Shakespearean vitae. Very soon, no one who physically experienced the World War II era will be alive. The planet vacant of them, as it is the vanished generation of World War I and the 20th century plague. So too, Dust Bowl relics of the Great Depression. Eventually, history might well connect the world wars into a single holocaust, perhaps as well the two plagues of two centuries, the first at the end of one millennium, this current pandemic at the advent of another. The possible extinction of humanity looms ever near as previous historical anxieties recede into collective amnesia. The species totters like a single human person who has survived many previous dreadful experiences, yet death is always imminent with no final escape. History, whether personal or collective, is treated as though it is of little consequence to the here and now. Yet knowledge of the present is much enhanced by familiarity of how it has come about. And also history might help synthesize better ideas for future thought and practice. Concentration on the past could cripple imaginative ideas for the future. Yet it might also be considered how much Galileo depended on the earlier theories of Copernicus. The late Massachusetts Democratic Senator Paul Tsongas, who campaigned for the presidency in 1992 but lost the Democratic primary to Bill Clinton, hit a good note when he said that politics are supposed to protect, preserve, and strengthen the heritage of our ancestors and hand it on to our successors. Recalling his nearly fatal earlier bout with cancer, which he said caused him to think of the early generations, what they attempted, failed, and succeeded, and as a result of them, the currently living we who are what we are. But unfortunately, most of us only think of now, this place, this time. Our past still lies ahead of us, Lewis Mumford wrote. Or perhaps, as Richard Stengel counter-perceived, our future lies behind us. Today's program is about two persons, a woman and a man, both now dead, whom I have loved, admired, and indelibly respected, born 5 days and 1 year apart. The woman, Loyola Marcef, was born 80 years ago yesterday, on Cinco de Mayo, 1941. And the man, Arthur Honeyman, progenitor of spastic power, was born on May 10th, 1940. Loyola was an extraordinary and exotically beautiful woman, seasoned by generations of Eastern European ancestry. She was born the year of Pearl Harbor, on the fabled anniversary of Mexico's repatriation from French imperialism, which violated the U.S.-imposed Monroe Doctrine that no foreign nation should seize power in the Western Hemisphere, except, of course, the Yankee Doodle suzerain. The cruel but ill-fated French monarchist reign of Emperor Maximilian and Carlotta resulted from Civil War distraction by the dis-United States, which was a furious turmoil over slavery and racism that persists into this 21st millennial century. Of course, nearly two decades earlier, the USA seized through war with Mexico what is now its own Southwest, following a successful diplomatic finesse with Great Britain for the Pacific Northwest, known at the time as the Oregon Territory. All of it originally genocidally agglomerated by the three Euro-American contestants from indigenous residents. Loyola Marcef described herself as a gardener, poet, and grandmother just before her death at the cusp of her 60th birthday in 2001 in Washington. She had lived a long time in Portland, had been a resident of Cannon Beach and later Newport, Oregon. She was named Loyola by her father, who had been a member of the Catholic laity and promised that his firstborn child would be named after the Jesuit founder, Ignatius Loyola. She was eternally grateful she did not grow up with the name Iggy. She wrote an open letter to Hillary Clinton via the North Coast Times Eagle, the March 1994 edition, when Hillary Clinton was First Lady of the USA. An open letter to Hillary Clinton. Dear Hillary, by Loyola Marcef. To begin, a great thank you for your long and continuing efforts on behalf of health reform in this country. Since you took up this cause, much faith and hope have been directed your way toward positive change and growth in this sensitive area. Now, to those spokespeople for holistic, alternative, or complementary care, I add my voice. As you have so aptly stated on occasion, our health care is the best in the world. I know of no one who would disagree with this statement in regard to our expertise and technology in the operating theater, especially for accident victims. However, when it comes to illness and healing, many of us in this country are not so confident of American health care. For when Western medicine took its great journey out onto the peninsula of science, technology, surgery, and prescription drugs, it lost the path to the pearl of wisdom from which all healing comes. It misplaced the vital connection between body and spirit, and since body and spirit cannot be separated without causing illness and death, this whole healthcare reform issue knocks upon the very door which the first Europeans opened when they migrated to this country, that of freedom, and spiritual freedom in particular. The truth will out is an old saying and true, for central to all holistic healing arts and sciences is the golden kernel of truth about health itself, which the youthful West has yet to discover. This key has been known for centuries in the East, coming first, as did Zen, from India in the science of Ayurveda, and then to be rediscovered and practiced in China, and now, here in this country, where newly planted seeds of understanding are sprouting. As a result of the tangent upon which American medicine currently operates, there are many of us in this country who have, out of necessity, begun to educate ourselves about the fundamentals of healing and who have come to realize that we are our primary caregivers and we have begun to take primary responsibility for our own health, complementing our own care with a host of healing arts and sciences. When we are out of balance or have disease, we now also have the growing knowledge of why and know where and what help to seek, be it the herbalist, the naturopath, the masseuse, the chiropractor, the acupuncturist, to name a few. And though it will not be told here, the simplicity of health and healing is so profoundly gentle and disarming that we could teach its secret to all first graders in this country, were we not so busy weaving American healthcare from the bundles of politics, fear, and finance, a dangerously weak and expensive fabric. Now, the prospect of healthcare reform, in which we will not only be obliged to procure, at great cost, insurance, which a great many will, for the most part, not need or use, but also the fact that the primary health care services which we do use will for the most part not be covered, is adding injury to insult. It is not only unfair and un-American, but also it is the death knell for Western medicine. For Western medicine may be about the body, but holistic medicine holds also the spirit, and unless there is a meeting and a marriage between these, healthcare reform will be in name only, and we will not be healthy as a people and as a nation. For being American is about choice. Choice is an inalienable right. Choice is healing, is freedom. Let it ring. I speak, for is this not still the land of the free and the home of the brave? And that was Dear Hillary by Loyola Marcet. And now, the second person. Arthur Honeyman was one of Oregon's most famous and notorious spastics. He was born with cerebral palsy on May 10, 1940, and spent most of his life fighting for the rights and recognition of people who are considered physically handicapped. He was a teacher, poet, and writer, author of the award-winning Sam and His Cart, which was made into a movie, and a plethora of other books, essays, and collections of his poetry. He had a Bachelor's of Science degree in History and Master's of Art in English. He wrote of himself, "I am a spastic. I am a freak. My body shakes like four winds tearing at it from all points of the compass. My speech is tortured almost to being incomprehensible. I drool and vomit almost uncontrollably. I also cannot eat unless someone feeds me. To go to the bathroom, someone has to take me to the toilet and wait until I am finished. I am an adult and have to be cared for like a six-month-old baby." But, he wrote, his mind was free. He was the originator of spastic power. "Spastic power is irrational, but so is love," he said. Arthur died at age 68 on December 8, 2008, the 86th anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. Arthur kept an old Peanuts cartoon on a wall of his house. Charlie Brown says, "My mind is at war with my body," which succinctly describes the core of Arthur's shaky life. He wrote, "If cripples don't shape up," for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1979. He had an irregular column in the Poverty Press publication under the rubric "On Shaky Ground." If Cripples Don't Shake Up by Arthur Honeyman. If cripples don't shape up, they must die. Cripples will scorn this statement while lackadaisically lapping up welfare. They don't realize that the heyday for cripples is rapidly coming to a close, and that only a constant struggle for survival will preserve their race as being useful to humanity. The fact of the matter is that Darwin was right after all. Survival of the fittest is the rule of the universe. On Earth, Homo sapiens is a communal form of life, and in its eternal quest for more community, has destroyed the rest of the planet and accepted the cripple into his community as a necessary scapegoat, thus promoting it his self-image as a compassionate being. Perhaps this is part of a long-range evolutionary process, and perhaps natural selection is taking place. But mankind is racing towards self-extinction and extinction of the whole earthly colony. Through genetics, the cripple will probably be extinguished mercifully. But suppose the cripple is actually an evolutionary link to the future non-physical essence floating around the universe as propounded in the fantasy The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. If this is true, the cripple does have a purpose. If this is true, genetic control will only mean the ultimate stagnation of the so-called progression of the human being. Through genetic control, man will stop his own existence. So the idea is to perpetuate all possibilities of the future of the planet and the human race. The idea is to persuade the rest of humanity that the cripple is essential to the creative continuation of life on Earth and future unknown space. Man will not understand this long-range quest. Rather, he will view the immediate situation, the overpopulation of the world and utilitarian needs of the present and not too distant future. So the cripple needs to get off his or her butt and prove useful to man's existence right now, rather than being a Christian burden to be endured for the love and blood of Christ. The cripple must stop sucking pariah light and its linguistic connotations, confirming the liberal Christian tradition that certain members of humanity need to be classified in a have a pity on category. There is no more space on earth. Someone must die. The ancients were right after all. Cripples must be blood sacrificed onto the rocks, into the soil, for the future growth of olive trees and the final tranquility of mankind. It is 1984 and warfare is out of the question. Blood sacrifice is barbaric and has sunk into the anomaly of non-symbol and non-myth. Psychology has therapeutically drained sorrow and compassion from the human essence into a strictly existential satisfaction. The cripple must die because there isn't room for him. He must die bloodlessly because humanity doesn't recognize that he has blood or muscles or sexual potency. The human race is weeded, and the cripple, a malformation and useless entity of all races, is plucked. Imagine the existence of the cripple and his struggle for daily survival. Imagine him and her in a semi-warfare state being cared for by that state and by his or her family. Imagine his lack of psychological potency. Imagine every day taking more than giving or contributing to the community. The cripple is fed, clothed, cleaned, sheltered, and is entertained by society. And what is the price? The price is being the psychological butt of the community, and ultimately, after a fruitless life, death. Generally, the cripple's death is early, not just because of his physical condition, but also because he's got nothing to live for. Generally, the cripple is an uneducated sheep. But what about the rare cripple who is educated? He is aware of his psychological social castration and needs to make a choice of either remaining castrated or constantly struggling against his stigma. Generally, this individual falls back on excuses and sophisticated recognition of his plight in lazy cynicism. His cynicism is not the kind that pushes forward, but holds back, vapidly acknowledges self-impotence, and rests on laurels of sophisticated knowledge and views. Although the United States seems to give the cripple the best and freest chance of any place in the world, the empire is too large and cumbersome to mollycoddle members of society who cannot or will not take care of themselves in the communal sense of the world. Communal means mutual giving and taking in a group of people coexisting. The cripple rarely gives and takes mutually. The average cripple doesn't even try. This seems to be a rule which remains unspoken, and generally the rule is a shock when verbalized, especially when a cripple verbalizes it. Verbalizing is one step towards doing something about it. The realistic redneck will say, shoot them and get it over with. The liberal will give them welfare and continue to buy the cripple's castration. The more sophisticated liberal will sacrifice the innocent lamb by urging the cripple to do it himself and then remove his testicles clitoris after he, she has become a failure. The enigma of the whole situation is that the radical does not even seem to acknowledge the existence of cripples because everyone is crippled. Naturally and actually, all these views are right. The pariah should be shot. The poor cripple should get more than subsistence and shouldn't risk genitals to get something done. There is something to be said for the conviction that without welfare, people would be forced to survive or die under their own initiative. Thus, the problem of what to do with cripples is a complex issue. The radicals are right. Every human being is a cripple. But society does not treat every cripple as a human being. The question is how cripples should be treated, especially if cripples don't want to be treated paternalistically, yet depend on society for daily subsistence. The whole issue is so complex and profound as to boggle and confound not only human imagination, but the history of the cripple and his place in the social community as well. The question even staggers Marxian dialectics. The cripple simply does not fit into the normal scheme of things. Ask the black, the Jew, the Indian, etc. The aged have already made their contribution and generally, except in today's American society, are respected for it. But the cripple has no tradition of contributing in any society, except for a few individuals who managed to rise to the challenge. And most of them were wealthy, and thus no tradition of respect. Some have said that the only answer is small communities, but in a small town, the cripple not only sticks out like a sore thumb, his chances of being self-sufficient and a contributing member of the community are less than in a larger, more sophisticated community. Also, the day of small communities is gone. Historically, children have been forced to grow into men and women by being thrown into life and exposed to its harsh realities rather than being protected. Women, fortunately or unfortunately, have been thrown into motherhood. Men, also unfortunately, have been thrown into some kind of military duty. The general exception to this pattern has been dissidents or cripples. Dissidents have purposely rebelled against their background, tradition, and training. Cripples have been taught from the beginning that it's not realistic to expect to go into training for future life, future usefulness, future self-sufficiency. Paradoxically, they have been trained by not being trained. If the cripple is to survive, he must act on several levels. First, he must acknowledge his past with pride, pride because he still exists despite society. Secondly, he must acknowledge his past with shame, shame because he is a victim of society. Third, likewise, he must acknowledge all his pains and all his joys, all his failures and all his successes, all his symbolic meanings and all his real meanings, just like the rest of mankind. Fourth and finally, he must seize the responsibility which has been denied him, the responsibility he has denied himself. He must plunge into the complex morass and synthesize it to his advantage. Cripples in general are just as physically capable as anyone else, but they are not trained to deal with survival as a routine reality. For example, cripples are able to accomplish phenomenal feats such as painting with a paintbrush in their mouth or between their toes, weightlift fantastic amounts of pounds with just arm strength. Those without legs can climb ladders over 100 feet high, stumps dangling in the breeze, and other grotesque yet useful feats that boggle the cultural imagination. But these people are a sideshow. They are not trained to put their capabilities to daily use in society or even separate from society. They are trained from birth to do tricks, to perform for the board, to exhibit their skills to the zoo watchers. If this is a ruthless indictment, it is because even the great artists and writers have depicted the grotesque for grotesque's sake and have thus evaluated them as such. To train the cripple in the art of usefulness, a cripple is needed. A cripple not born crippled and who has a grasp on the various subtleties and modes of survival, primordial and social. And that was "If Cripples Don't Shape Up" by Arthur Honeyman. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. Bloody Monday is on a Tuesday this year, but its plague canceled 50th anniversary last year on May 11th, 2020, was on a Monday. That particular commemoration was to be about the destruction of an ersatz hospital by Portland police, whose attack on anti-Vietnam War protesters sent many of the assailed to several other hospitals, a grim irony. May 11th is also known to Oregon as its Day of Discovery in 1792, when Boston ships Captain Robert Gray crossed the bar and sailed into the mighty river of the West, which he named after the namesake of his ship, Columbia Redivivva, 300 years after the great navigator, Christopher Columbus, thought he had reached India in 1492. Cinco de Mayo has a separate distinction for Oregonians. On that day in 1945, just 3 days before VE Day and 3 months before the atomic bombings of Japan, a woman and five children were killed by a detonating fire balloon sent across the Pacific Ocean one of several thousand such devices intended to start forest fires and create panic on the Pacific coast of the USA. The woman, a minister's wife, and the five children were on a Sunday school picnic in the mountains nearby Oregon. They were the only mainland American casualties during World War II, and the first deaths caused by the first intercontinental ballistic weapons in history. Humanity is engaged in as desperate and vicious a world war as any we fought among ourselves. This against a deadly virus that is engaged in germ genocide. Stay locked down, vaccinate, wear a mask in public, save others by saving yourselves.